गुरुदेव महेश्वरा गुरु साक्षात् परब्रह्मा तस्मै श्री गुरवे नमः. आई एम ऑनर्ड टू बी हियर दिस इवनिंग रिप्रेजेंटिंग माय गुरु. आई हैव नो अदर पर्पस इन लाइफ एंड येट आई नो दैट द पर्टिकुलर फंक्शन दैट ही हैज गिवन मी टू प्ले इज नॉट अ स्मॉल वन. Jesus Christ needed his Saint Paul. His close disciples who were with him had been brought up as fishermen, as people in the simple culture they lived in. But somebody was needed to show the context of this teaching to the whole world. Saint Paul had been brought up in the Roman world. He knew all the different trends of civilization at that time and could show the place of the teachings of Christ and of Christ himself in that era. My guru often told me, you have a great work to do, and I didn't know what it meant, but one thing I knew was that it was not a compliment. It was a duty that he was giving me. And I came gradually to understand what he meant, that I had to be his Saint Paul. How saintly, I don't know, but I had to fulfill that particular mission. I was born with that particular direction from the beginning. I was born, as I think most of you know, I was born in Romania, but of American parents. I grew up in Europe during the time of the rise of communism and of Nazism. I remember the tremendous conflicts that were raging at that time in the 1930s. As the Nazis came on, it was born of Darwinism and the thought that the evolution of man depends on survival of the fittest. And the Germans were claiming to be the fittest, and therefore we would survive and we would be the master race. And there was so much of this kind of thinking, and I, in my heart, I rebelled. I said, this is not true. And in communism, I was born virtually on the border of, in fact, it was on the border of Russia. And I used to feel that there's something wrong with this teaching that exalts the common man and doesn't speak of the heights to which we can rise. Everything is a push upward from below. There was something wrong with that. And in the science, in which they declared that everything is just material and that all aspiration and all spiritual hunger and all idealism was strictly a delusion, that the whole reality was nothing but material, that consciousness is only a matter of the right kind of combinations of energies in the brain which make men conscious. Even today, there is unbelievably this concept that if you can develop computers enough, robots enough, sensitive to become conscious, then we will be able to build human beings just out of matter. In fact, there is even today, believe it or not, in America, talk about thinking of computers' rights, as if computers were beings that we could finally bring to that point of sophistication where they might even be able to take over us and our society. This was the thinking even back in the 1920s and earlier, that robots would finally rise up in rebellion against their creators and create a more perfect society that would be mechanistic and not have all the imperfections of mankind to deal with and to cause all the upsets. Unbelievable. But I often used to think, you think that sophistication will produce consciousness? What about a worm? What could be less sophisticated than a worm? And yet it is obviously not only conscious, but self-conscious. You try to prick a pin into a worm, it'll try to squirm away. It knows that it's being affected. It knows that it itself is being affected. No, the whole understanding of modern times has been upside down. And the right understanding of this began with Jagadish Chandra Bose in Bengal, who pointed out, he discovered that matter and consciousness are the same thing, that there is no difference between a moving leaf or even a rock and metal and mankind. Karl Bonhoeffer in Germany discovered this sometime later, that the energy, the electricity that you put through a wire can have the same effect as the energy coming through our nervous system, that there is no difference between matter and consciousness, non-living and living matter. It is all one. The belief that scientists come up with as a result of this is that nothing is conscious. Of course, it takes consciousness to say that, doesn't it? The other possibility, and it's an obvious one, but people have not thought of it, but I did explain this in a book of mine, Out of the Labyrinth, that therefore either nothing is conscious or everything is conscious. This is what Jagadish Chandra Bose proved, not just claimed philosophically, proved in his laboratory, that everything is alive. This is the ancient teaching of Vedanta. It's the ancient teaching of yoga. And it is fitting that India, the most ancient of all continuing cultures in the world, should have preserved this truth for mankind. What England brought to India in the way of scientific knowledge and so on, India is now bringing back to the West. But you all have been westernized, and you don't perhaps understand the very great depths of this culture in which you live. As I said, I was born in Romania, and I grew up. I was educated in Switzerland, in England. I learned, before I was even an adult, four languages, which I could speak fluently. And from then on, I had to learn other languages, Italian, I knew German, Romanian, French, Spanish, I had to learn. Then I came here, and I would have learned Indian languages, Hindi and Bengali. I know them to some extent, but the trouble is that you Indians wouldn't allow me to speak Hindi and Bengali. You would answer me in English. So this has been my problem. I cannot speak Hindi fluently. I can speak it a little bit. Hindi se mera Bangla acha hai. Lekin, people just don't let me really talk the language. And yet, I have to say that the oneness of our languages, you know, a Christian missionary one time said to me, "What are you doing in this orange robe?" I said, "What do you mean when you say," he said to me, "what do you mean when you use the word saint?" I said, "I'm referring to the Sanskrit word sant, from which our word has come." All these things, pat, path, same word. Our language comes from Sanskrit. Sanskrit is the mother tongue of the whole world, my guru used to say. And the English did their best to disprove this, but they talked about the Aryan invasion. There was never such an invasion. It all came from here. And the other countries when you go to Africa, you find there's a lot of black magic there. I went to the Cairo Museum, and I discovered there that there was a feeling of black magic there. It seemed as if Egypt, that great and high culture, had fallen on hard times and gotten into black magic. I think there's the karma in the rest of the world that India has not lost, because it has preserved You people think of the saints in the Himalayas as wasting their lives. They are not. They are the bulwark of this country. They are preserving that power. And from that, India has maintained, as it says in the Bible, if 10 righteous men could be found living in that city, it would not be destroyed. Unfortunately, there were not 10 righteous men, and so it had to be destroyed. But karma is a supreme law. Now, these things I came upon gradually as a necessity in my searching, because it was my destiny to help to show how this teaching of my guru was not just a beautiful teaching, but narrow. It's cosmic. It's global. And this is what I want to help you to understand tonight, that what I represent tonight is not just the teaching of another guru. It is that, yes, but it's much, much more. My guru's guru, Swami Sri Yukteswar, made a discovery which Indians even yet have not come upon. They have not yet come to understand. But more and more these things are becoming clarified. He said in his book, which he wrote, The Holy Science, in 1894, that we are in a new age. This is not Kali Yuga. This is Dwapara Yuga. He said that there is a mistake that came into the chronicles. Now, when a great master talks like that and makes corrections, he's talking from a high level. If another master speaks of this as Kali Yuga, he's not put his mind to it. He's just accepting the traditions of the times, just as much as they accept the language of the times. You know, the language isn't perfect, but you use it. So they talk that way. But Sri Yukteswar had the different qualification of being also a great astronomer and astrologer. And he was able to show that the age in which we are living is no longer the Kali Yuga of those times. 500 AD was when the Yugas came down to their lowest point, and from then on they have been rising. Kali Yuga is not destined to be 4,000 and 3,400, I mean, and 32,000 years. It is much, much shorter. If, given the present rate of degeneration which we see around us, and it's inescapable, if that continued for another 430,000 years, I can't think that we would become anything but worms ourselves. But there is something else that you see, that in this age, there is suddenly a whole new view of things. He said that the Kali Yuga began rising into 1,200 years of each Kali Yuga, descending and ascending. He said that the sun goes around our dual, as he spoke of, in such a way as to bring us in these cycles that are 1,200 years Kali Yuga, descending and ascending, not a thing which some people have written, an end of a Kali Yuga and suddenly a golden age of Satya Yuga again. No, everything in nature is cyclic. And so this cycle goes from Kali Yuga to Dwapara to Treta to Satya and back again, up and down, constantly succeeding cycles of time. And in this, he said that the Dwapara began, the first Chandya of it, began in 1700. You see that from then on, the last dying Chandya of Kali Yuga was from 1600 to 1700 AD. And we see in that time that Galileo Galilei and all these other great scientists, Newton and so on, began to come up with the Industrial Revolution that began from that period. There became a whole ferment. And in 1900, Swami Sri Yukteswar walked through the streets of Serampore with a little parade of his disciples, declaring that Dwapara Yuga proper had begun. And people threw stones at him because they said, no, no, this isn't so. But nonetheless, we have seen since that time things, changes that are almost unbelievable. You know, back in 1949, the Popular Science Monthly in America, I think it was that magazine, declared that someday computers will be will weigh as little as one ton. Well, 1979, the president of IBM said that there is no chance that computers will ever be in the homes. The changes that we have seen in my lifetime, when I was a young boy in school in England, at 12 years old or so, a teacher told me with amazement that all the stars that you see here in the heavens are only one star system. He said that they have found that there are two or maybe even three other star systems. Mind you, this is in my lifetime. They have discovered since then that there are 100 billion such galaxies in the universe. Unbelievable how airplane travel, radio, television, computers, it just goes on and on and on. And we are definitely in a new age of understanding. Now, my guru's I feel that his job was to introduce Dwapara Yuga. This was his function. And therefore, he was sent to America, the new country. You know, it's not the newest country, really. In another way, you can put it this way, that England is the oldest continuous government in the world. And the second oldest is the United States of America. All other countries are new in that sense, but of course in the other sense, America is a new country. And it's a country made for adaptation to the new age. Now we go to the opposite end of the spectrum with India, where India, I remember I was talking to a young man in 1959 here in India. I lived here for 4 years then. And he was a young businessman. So being an American, naturally I thought of ways he could improve things. And I offered him suggestions for his business. What was very interesting to me was that he didn't judge my ideas on the basis of their merit. He said, but you see, sir, this is how my father did it. You are living in a country that is both very old, but very adaptable. This is the absolutely incredible thing about the Indian mentality. It's not that people are different. Americans, Indians, Africans, we're all the same. But we have certain cultural things that make it possible for us to rise. Your caste system is a great misfortune and yet a great fortune. It holds people down, but also it offers them a way to rise. And it offers them the direction to rise. The possibility of becoming a great yogi and becoming one with Brahman. There is no other culture or religion in the world that teaches the principle of Kaivalya Moksha. This has made it possible for Indians. I was on my way to India when I came here the first time in 1958, I stopped in the islands of Fiji. There were some 300,000 Indians living there. And they had all come there as indentured laborers. That means from a low caste. And yet, in the very short time that they had been there, they had gotten educated, they had gotten degrees, there were lawyers, there were doctors. They were coming up very quickly. All over the world, wherever I have been, I have seen that Indians rise very quickly in society because there is that in their culture that makes them think in those terms. It's not a question of your being more intelligent, but you are encouraged to use that intelligence. And so as I come back now to India, I realize that computers, you're experts in. Biotechnology is a natural. These are things that you have a polarization here between the old, which is very old and very very stifled in its ways. Then you have this new thing. And a computer engineer cannot say, well, how did his father do computers? A scientist cannot say, well, my father was a biochemist. He wasn't. And so you've got this new thing and this ability to come up into this new way of looking at things. And I myself hope very much to help to inspire this kind of thing. We've got an invention that we hope will really work for making very cheap electricity out of solar power. And another one that we have, and it's in cooperation with Indians because they've invented this wonderful dynamo that they can create with wind power that nobody in the world has done so well. And we would like to bring this, not thinking in terms, oh, we can become billionaires, but rather we can serve. And it would be wonderful to bring this energy and electricity into all the villages where over in one generation, these villagers, you know, there's a book by an American. He's not, I don't know if he's an American citizen or not. He's an Indian. He was born as a very low caste person. And somehow his family got got together, his village got together, they gave him an education, he went to America, he became a billionaire. He discovered laser surgery and eyes, and he's a great man. It's wrong, and it's one of the curses of every civilization has its curses. The caste system, as it's used, has become a curse. And yet, if we can understand that its purpose is to show people how to rise, that a Shudra cannot get better of people by just beating them up. He can become start using his brain and become a Vaishya. And a Vaishya can become more successful, not as he just thinks in terms of becoming rich by cunning, but by using his ability to help other people too. And so he becomes a Kshatriya. And the Kshatriya understands that helping other people instead of merely ruling over them is the purpose of a ruler is to serve his people, not to dominate over them. And so he can become a Brahmin, and you can become that in one lifetime. As it says in the Bhagavad Gita, that even the worst of sinners, that would have to be a Shudra, wouldn't it? Quickly comes to me if he steadfastly meditates on me. Everybody has that potential. The beautiful thing about the caste system is that it shows that the direction of energy is this way. If you try to become successful in other ways, you won't make it. But if you go in this way, that the Shudra must learn to use his intelligence. The person who has intelligence should use it to expand his consciousness by serving other people. Somebody who has expanded his consciousness, instead of ruling over them, can serve. And then he can understand gradually the consciousness of a Brahmin, that God is the one doing everything. And so beyond, finally you become Triguna Rahitam, beyond all the gunas. This is the goal of life. And this is the wonderful contribution of Indian society, which has yet to be understood by Indians. You still have this belief that the Aryan invasion, which was a complete myth of Westerners, that you still think that's true. It is not true. The civilization, this is the core of civilization in the world. I'm saying this as an American, but I'm not an American. We're all souls who have come into these bodies in one form or another for one purpose or another. My guru said that nowadays God wants the East and the West, and especially America and India, to unite. And as I look at many Indians today, I see Wall Street brokers and bankers walking in Indian bodies. And as I meet many Americans in America, I see that they're not Americans. They're really Indians in American bodies. I know that I am that myself. But it's needed because we need to bring unity into the world. Now, the one thing that my guru brought was unity. He brought unity on all levels. And this was a part of my own training before I even came to him. Because I grew up in the Episcopal Church, which is the Anglican Church. And I was baptized in Ploiești in Romania at our little church there. And I grew up, my mother was very devout, but I began to feel that this is not anything real. There's got to be a truth in this. It can't just be belief. You can believe the world is flat. That doesn't make the world flat. The world is what it is. We misunderstand what things are and not feel that we have defined our religion because we believe this or believe that. Shraddha must come from a deeper level than just intellect. It has to come from the heart. It has to come from recognition of the soul. And so I first wanted to be a scientist, and I wanted to be an astronomer. And gradually I came to realize that knowing how large the universe is, knowing how things function outwardly, that's not helping me, because it's not giving me what I want as a human being. I want love, I want joy, I want happiness. How large the universe is doesn't have anything to do with this. Rather, it seems to diminish me, and yet, you know, a very interesting thing. Copernicus discovered that the world is not the center of the universe. And then gradually, we've come to the point where we understand that the universe, God's, that consciousness, and this is an ancient teaching in India, that divine consciousness centered everywhere, circumference nowhere. That God, when he created the universe, didn't create it the way we create statues. He had to go from inside out. At every point of the universe is his center. From that center, he evolves outwardly. He evolves the body from the union of sperm and ovum cells. He evolves little trees from little seeds. Everything comes from a center. And that center, another point to really understand is that the center is not, every atom is the center of the universe, okay, but you can never understand the atom. You have to become that. The only center you will ever understand is your own self. And so from finding that the world is not the center of the universe, we reach the point of understanding that each one of us is the center of the universe. There is no center. It all begins from that little point. And this is where Kriya Yoga comes into the picture, and it is the highest science of all. We have to now understand that religions are one. There's no separation. That science and religion are one. That true religion has to be scientific. And the truest science is that science which helps you to know the highest truth, which is your own self. The highest science is yoga. And the highest science of yoga is Kriya Yoga. Now, how do I make that statement? This is what I want to try to justify today, to help you to understand how very central this teaching is in all that we do in our lives. First of all, this idea that science and religion are separate. If truth is truth, then if divine, then religion has to be scientific. But science cannot be anything but experience. The scientist, the physicist, the chemist, they go on experience, experiment, don't they? Well, religion, the experiment in religion is experience. I wanted to be a scientist first, as I told you. I realized that wasn't what I was looking. And then I thought, well, maybe Marxism or some political system will do it. And I realized before long that you can't change people by forcing them this way or that way. When I was 15, I decided I wanted to start a community where I thought that if a few people can learn to live right, then they can offer an example to others instead of forcing them and killing everybody who doesn't agree with you. And there was another thing that I did then. I wrote a play called The Peace Treaty. This play I have sophisticated over the years. I've written so that it's a good play now. But its basis is this, that the peace that we're looking for in society must come from people. It cannot come from a system. It cannot come from the government. How, when I was new in India here, they were trying to impose socialism on the nation. It didn't work. You can't make people do this or do that. They have to do it. They have to want to do it. What we still have is a system that's full of corruption. It's the individuals in society who need to proclaim the kind of world they want. And this is what happened in in the peace treaty, that these rulers were finally pushed aside and the people decided they wanted peace. You and I need to work for that individually. The peace of mankind will come when man reaches that point in a majority. You'll never find everybody that way. But when man as a whole wants to live in harmony. Now, we've started that in our communities. You don't ever find people shouting at each other, insulting each other, fighting each other. You just don't find it there. Because they all live together for an ideal. It's not just an ordinary village. They come because they want God. They come because they want to share with others who want God. They come because they want to help one another to find God as well as finding Him themselves. One little example of that. Supposing each one of our members, we have about 1,000 people living in these different communities already. Supposing each one of them went to a different city and worked in a business and lived in the suburbs. And he would be, because he meditates regularly, a peaceful person. But people might say to him, how come you're so peaceful and everybody else is getting all excited and upset? And he could say, well, it's because I meditate. And they would say, well, it's probably because you take bran for breakfast. They couldn't relate to it. Or because you're a very special kind of person. But they wouldn't be able to believe this is something they could do. Somebody came to me at the village in America, Ananda Village, and said, you have some wonderful people here. I said, you know what? If you see one or two people like that, you can say they're wonderful people. When you see everybody like that, you have to say it is what they are doing that makes them that way. And this we have seen, that people will come full of the tensions that the world builds up, and after just a few weeks, they begin to calm down. We all want peace. We all want harmony. Why don't we have it? The world doesn't breed that in you, but if you can see that it's possible to live together with other few people and live in harmony, then you automatically want that. So we have a community where instead of living in separate towns, they all live together. And people come from as far away as Taiwan and India and all over the world to visit us because we have made that kind of impact. Next year, we will celebrate our 40th anniversary. That's a long enough time to prove what you have, to prove that it works or to disprove it. Now, in my seeking, I realize that this culture that we are living in today is in a state of crisis. Science has brought people to the point of atheism, of thinking that there is nothing, no meaning in life, no purpose in life. Religion has brought us to the point of thinking that my religion is the only one and they're fighting each other. And so you have terrorists. They think that people who terrorize others, thinking that they can convert everybody to their way of thinking, once they finally succeeded, if they were able to succeed, they would all be fighting each other. You can't find peace by destroying people. You can find it by being peaceful, not by terrorism. We find too much opposition in the different religions together, each one saying, mine is the only one and mine is the only one. I wrote a book, which is just coming out in India too now, Revelations of Christ Proclaimed by Paramahansa Yogananda. And in that book, I show that there is only one religion in the whole world. It is Sanatana Dharma. I don't mean the Sanatana Dharma of Ganesha, of Kali, of Lakshmi, of Vishnu. No, these are names, these are particular things that grow up in a culture. But that Sanatana Dharma, which says that everything was brought into manifestation from consciousness. Consciousness is the only and one abiding reality in the entire universe. And from this consciousness, God evolved everything. Now, another thing, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, it would have been very difficult to say that we are all just His consciousness. Everything looks so real. But now science itself has shown, and this is how these different disciplines are coming together. Science and religion are coming closer and closer together all the time. Science has shown that everything is energy, that matter has no existence. This metal rod here on the microphone seems solid, but it's not. It's all vibration. Now, a question can arise easily in the mind. How can it just be vibration of energy? Science proves it, but here's a little illustration that will help you to understand it. When you have a tuning fork, the tines move back and forth, and it looks as if there's some substance between the two opposite movements. When you have a propeller on an airplane, it looks like a solid dish, doesn't it? And so it is that vibrations, when they're fast enough, they can take on the appearance of solidity. And this universe is a combination of trillions, inconceivable numbers of different vibrations so that my hand cannot pass through my flesh. so that I can't go through this thing. And yet, of course I could. They say scientists have proved now that there is as much space in our bodies as there is, relatively speaking, out in outer space between the stars and the planets. The nearest star takes 4 light years to reach our planet. It's light. 4 light years at traveling at 300,000 kilometers a second. There's an enormous amount of space in this body. If you were to remove that space, you would condense your body to a little point so small that you might not even be able to see it, and yet it would have that same weight. And yet that weight, too, is only an illusion. It isn't a reality. And so science is showing us that we are really made of energy. But there are scientists today, Eddington was one, Sir James Jeans was another, more and more beginning to say it today, things look suspicious, as if energy may be only consciousness. And so we're veering to that point where this, my guru taught a system of energization exercises, which is very worth learning, because it helps you to energize your body with willpower. He showed that with willpower directed, the greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. And so with this flow of will into your body, you can fill your body with energy. The divine, having first these ideas, willed them outward to take on the form of energy, which then was willed to take on the form of matter. It cannot go further than that, because the consciousness cannot go further than the appearance of total inertia, as you find in the rocks. But indeed, there is no such thing. The rocks themselves are filled with vibrations of energy. And so we see that science is bringing us closer and closer to what religion is all about. Religion is not a question of Jesus Christ lived and he's the only Son of God. How can one man be the only Son, the only creation conscious, whatever you want to call him, of somebody who could produce 100 billion galaxies? It's too ridiculous for words. Jesus Christ was the Christ, and the Christ is the infinite. You know, it's so interesting that Christ and Krishna are very similar words. They're similar truths also. He was the Christ for this reason. People have said that the Trinity in Hinduism is Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. That's not true. Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva is the Trinity of Om, the Om vibration which manifested everything. Brahma was that manifesting thing, which is a different vibration. When you hear this in meditation, you will hear a higher sound as the vibration of Om creating. Then when it's on a preservative level, it goes like this. It's very much like a motor. You take a motorcycle or a car. When it starts out like that, then when it reaches speed, then it goes. Then when it's time to stop, just the same. You know, it's so wonderful to find these illustrations in our daily lives, which we can apply to spiritual truths, because that is what these three vibrations are. But that's only the vibrations of Om. Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva are not people. They are personifications of the infinite consciousness. And then the true Trinity, comparable to the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost in the Christian Trinity, is Om Tat Sat. God was Brahman, is Brahman. When he decided to manifest the universe, he set a little portion of his consciousness in vibration, and that was the beginning of the creation. And then that Om vibration took on many different manifestations of energy, of matter, of so on. And then within that, because you cannot have something separate from God that's different from God, within each vibration in the universe, there is a calm reflection of the Brahman beyond it. So Sat is the infinite Brahman. Om is the universe, the vibrational, conscious, divine mother, you might say. And then Sat Tat is the Kutastha Chaitanya, that consciousness of unmoving consciousness, which is pervades the entire universe. And this, when you achieve the state of samadhi, this is the state you go into. There's Om Samadhi, and then gradually go beyond Om Samadhi into oneness with the entire creation. From that, you merge into Brahman. Now, these truths must be understood correctly, because there cannot be another religion than this. The purpose of religion is to take you closer to God. And how can God be some old man with a long white beard? It's too ridiculous to think about. It just has to be an infinite consciousness. Now, the important thing to understand is that he created not just the trees and all of that. That's their business. But we're very much our business. How did he create us? We're a part of his consciousness. You know, it's a very interesting thing. I went through all this evolution of modern seeking through arts, through, I thought the arts of this 20th century, and of course even today, they're so full of nonsense. There's meaningless everywhere, meaninglessness. Picasso, what does it mean to have eyes like this and all sorts of weird shapes? I think people just don't, our culture has lost its bearing. It's lost its rudder. It's a ship without a rudder. And we need to bring back into the world a new culture, a new civilization. This is what my guru brought. He showed how on all levels these eternal truths apply, that art should be to inspire people. And what inspires them? Because it helps them to know where they should go and what they should do to find what they themselves want. Shankaracharya explained this beautifully. He said that the purpose of life is Satchitananda. This is the nature of the universe. Before my guru came to America, he wrote a book called The Science of Religion. I have re-edited it, but because it was edited by a disciple of his who was very intellectual, but it didn't have the warmth of my guru's vibration in it. And so I redid it, and I've called it God is for Everyone. And he showed in this book, which I've merely clarified, he showed that there's one thing that all people are seeking. You can call it two things in this sense. Everybody in the world is trying to escape pain and to find joy. And this is true for every creature, but we do it more consciously. We have this ego that is more developed in man than it is in the elephant or the dog. And with this ego, each one of us thinks, I'm separate from you. Each one of us is trying to develop his own self. Each one of us wants his own self-importance. Each one of us wants power or fulfillment or something. And the trouble with man is, you know, Darwin had it all wrong too. He was only talking about the outward forms. James Crowe, an American psychologist, wrote years ago, has man evolved more in producing a brain than the elephant has evolved in producing a trunk? It's a laughable thing if you think about it, but it's not laughable in Darwinian terms, because what's the difference? A brain, so it thinks, a trunk, it can grab leaves off a tree. But what Darwin didn't understand is that evolution really is that little consciousness gradually trying to express itself. And so it comes up, as it says in the Shastras, God sleeps in the minerals. He dreams in the plants. In the animals, he begins to wake up. In man, he knows he's awake. But then he has to become a superman by understanding what it is to be awake. And so the whole secret of evolution is the search of consciousness to find its way out. I wrote in that same book that I mentioned, Out of the Labyrinth, how it's certainly true what Darwin says. You can't argue with it. But it's superficial, because it's all mechanistic. Now, you take a leopard born, let us say, in a desert, and all the animals before it were without spots and could blend into the tawny sand and so not be seen. But suddenly you find a quirk, and an animal like that is found with spots. And so he will have less ability to survive, because it's prey will be able to see that there's an animal there in the sand. Well, for heaven's sake, it overlooks the simple fact that the leopard has enough intelligence to know that it should approach its prey from downwind, for example. It has intelligence, quite a lot of intelligence for its cease, or for what it is. Why would not an animal with spots seek out a jungle instead of the desert? A jungle where it wouldn't be seen. I mean, this is elemental. You see that animals have that level of intelligence. I remember when I was in Bucharest, my brother went out. I was 9, he was probably 7 at the time. And he went out with our little dog, Jasper, a little Scottish terrier. And there were these dog catchers who saw this dog in the care of a little boy, and they thought, well, they could catch it and get money for it for our having to come and pay to have it rescued from the dog kennel. And so they came with their net and wanted to grab Jasper, and my little brother grabbed their net and he shouted to them, to the little dog, run, Jasper, run! And Jasper got the point and he started running, and he ran down Boulevard Bouchetée, and when he saw he was out of sight of the catchers, he hid behind a bush. And they went rushing past him, and they came trotting proudly back home. Now, he had enough self-consciousness. For several weeks afterwards, we talked about his intelligence and hiding behind that bush. And as soon as he heard us, he knew what we were saying. He might be sitting under a table or wherever, and we would see him. He was very proud of his little display of intelligence. Well, you can see that there's a soul everywhere. And when that soul finally comes up to the human level, it usually stays there, but not always. What can go up can come down. And so you find in the Bhagavad Gita that it describes people coming into this Deha Brahman, Breha Brahma, and he throws them all out all over the universe, and they have to find their way back. You know, in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, it's a great scripture. It's not a love poem the way it seems to be. My guru wrote a wonderful commentary on that great scripture. As Omar Khayyam was a great Sufi saint. And in there it states also, as my guru explained, that many souls that are born at the day, beginning of a day of Brahma, are still wandering in delusion at the end of a day. You have to ask yourself, how long have you been going in this maya? Have you been going for days of Brahma? Yes, probably you have. It's a scary thought. I said to my guru one time, because somebody had a vision of being with him 80,000 years ago, I said, sir, have I been your disciple for thousands of years? He said, it's been a long time. That's all I will say. It has been a long time. Do you know, that same disciple said to Master one time, sir, I don't think I have very good karma. My guru replied like this. He said, remember this, it takes very, very, very good karma even to want to know God. People wander so many different ways. Oh, this face didn't please me, maybe that one will. This person didn't please me, maybe that one will. This job didn't do it, maybe that one will. This country didn't do it, maybe that one will. And so they go on and on and on. If I look at all your faces, it isn't genes that produce those faces. This is all the fallacy of modern science, that everything is materialistic and mechanistic. No, consciousness decided it all. You can see that in every face there's a whole lot of living behind that which produced that particular face which you have, that particular state of consciousness, all these samskaras that you have brought from many, many incarnations that have produced who you are right now. Now, what are you going to do about it? You are not who you think you are. If divine consciousness is center everywhere, circumference nowhere, so what's with you? You've got a circumference. That circumference is your self-definition. You think, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm an Indian, I'm an American, I'm a Frenchman, whatever it might be. I'm old, I'm young, I'm this, I'm that. And all the baggage of self-definition that you have acquired over countless incarnations, they're all written in your face. I had to be on a television program a few months ago, And I looked at all the people there and I thought, these are all my old friends. They looked familiar to me. You look familiar to me. We've all known each other in the past. Buddha said something quite frightening in a sense when he said, why should we love everybody? Because everybody in the world has at one time or another been close to us. That means we've been going for a long, long time, doesn't it? And yet, if we could just get out of it, and it looks like an impossible thing, it's like a lake covered with ice. Thousands of people on that lake could not break through that ice. They could walk on it. But there's one thing you can do. Wherever you are standing, you can drill through the ice and get down into that water underneath. This is the goal of sadhana. This is the goal of spiritual progress and spiritual effort. That when you can drill down deep into yourself, and this is where Kriya Yoga comes into the picture, where yoga comes into the picture, when you can go beyond your little thought that I'm doing it, and we need to do this in daily life too. I remember years ago, I went up to another upper part in our village in America, and I looked at the lights of the different homes there, and I thought, years ago there was no light here, and now there's light. I did this. Then I thought, do I like that thought? I said, no, I don't like that thought. It's so limiting. He did it. And I felt so free. Oh, I don't have to claim the responsibility of doing it. I don't have to worry about whether it works or doesn't work. He did it. You find that if you can really let him be the doer, and if everything you do, that there is many, many things happen as a result of that. You find it's like a sounding board in an instrument. You heard the guitar being played. If there had only been the strings, if there had been no board behind it, you wouldn't have heard them. But because that wood was there, it amplified it. So the infinite consciousness is like a sounding board. It is beneath all that that you do and all your thoughts, and if you tune into that, then you will suddenly see that there is power in what you do, that you have the power to change things, you have the power to help people. When I was in Charleston, I was about to tell you that story. I went out for a long walk. I had been rejecting religion because I thought that it didn't show me. I didn't see anybody in religion who seemed to have anything I wanted. They didn't have peace of mind. They were petty-minded. And they didn't have wisdom. They didn't have love. And I thought, what is the use of it? I had wanted to be an artist, and I was with a stage group learning the art of stagecraft because I wanted to be a playwright. And I realized, I don't know truth. Why should I inflict my ignorance on other people? And I saw all these people in the theater world, and they were so false. They were always acting parts that they weren't. Now, there's got to be something more to life than this. Scientists don't have it. Politicians don't have it. Artists don't have it. Religion doesn't have it. What does have it? And I took this long walk out into the countryside. And I said, "What if there's a God, what is that God? What can he possibly be?" And I realized that he has to be consciousness, because without that consciousness, I couldn't be asking this question. And if I am a part of that, if I am conscious, I have to be a part of that consciousness. And if I'm a part of that consciousness, then my duty in life is to try to be more in tune with that consciousness. That the closer I come to that infinite consciousness, the more I can accomplish in my life and in the world even. And the more out of tune I am, for instance, if I drink, or if I'm selfish, or if I don't think about other people, the less in tune I am with it. And therefore the goal of life is to find how to attune ourselves to that infinite consciousness. This thinking which you grew up with was so completely foreign to anything I had ever studied or read or known. It absolutely staggered me. I remember coming back, I was living with four other young men, and I just couldn't talk to them, and they were all laughing at me. I was so solemn, but I just felt this is something very important. And I decided I would give my life to seeking that truth. And I thought to become a hermit. Well, if I had just become a hermit not knowing anything, it would have been a disaster. But by divine grace, and this is, I want you to see this as an example of how God does intervene in our lives if we seriously are seeking Him. I didn't know anything about dharma, yoga, guru, karma. I didn't know anything of this philosophy. But my father, if I had come upon it when my father and mother were there, it probably would have been very difficult for me to make that break. But my father was shipped to Egypt, where he was given the job of being in charge of an exploration for oil there. And my mother was to join him, and we helped pack up everything, and I put her on the ship. The very day that I put her on that ship, I went uptown New York, I went into a bookstore, I found Autobiography of a Yogi. This book completely changed my life. I read it with tears and laughter, laughter of joy, tears of even greater joy. I had been willing to give up everything in the hope of finding a little peace of mind. And I found that the purpose of it all, the goal of life, is an incredible bliss, such joy beyond imagination. I took the next bus across the country, 4 days and four nights. And when I met my guru, I was an arrogant young American, thought I knew everything, although I knew I didn't know anything, and I was desperate to know something. I knew I needed help. First words I addressed to him were, "I want to be your disciple." And he accepted me right then. This was in 1948. I lived with him for 3.5 years. And he saw that I had all this education. He saw that I had all this background. He saw that I had the ability to explain to people how very important his teachings are in a global way, not just in a little way that you can go to your room and meditate and find God, but how everybody can, we can uplift all of society with this teaching. This is the purpose in my life. He told me that I had books to write, and I said to him, "But sir, haven't you written everything that's needed?" He looked a little shocked. He said, "Don't say that. Much more is needed." I was the only one of his disciples who understood this because I'd had that background. I can't say they understood less because they were less. They didn't have that education. They didn't have that background. But I used to feel it's their good karma that they can meditate, but I had this need to get out and bring this teaching to people, and he endorsed that need, and he said again and again, "You have a great work to do." And I've seen what he meant by that. Writing these books, I have tried to show in these books how that these teachings can help you to get a better education, be more successful in business, do everything that you need to do. From a godly life, you can accomplish everything better in this world. And because man thinks, "Well, God's all right where he is, but I've got to do this first," man doesn't succeed. And yet, it's so simple. When I was in a hospital 3 years ago, I had double pneumonia and I was unconscious practically. And a doctor came in, and it was a very surprising question for a doctor to ask a patient who is hardly conscious. He said, "Sir, can you help me?" I thought, "Well, I'll try." He said, "I have a son in college in Canada, and I have all these worldly responsibilities, and I have to make ends meet. How can I help and make ends meet and be completely dharmic?" And I said, "You know, I have discovered in my life that by being rigidly dharmic, I have been successful where nobody predicted I could possibly succeed." Well, I could have gone on in this vein with great enthusiasm, but the truth is I didn't have any enthusiasm. I was practically unconscious. And I have to say that lying there practically unconscious, I was not an advertisement for success. So I think that doctor left with great skepticism. But the next day, Leela brought me my lunch. She cooks for me. And so I roused myself from my unconsciousness to eat. And I said, "Leela, you know what I need to do is write a correspondence course on material success through yoga principles." Then I faded out and was unconscious again for the afternoon. And then Keshava came over. He's not here now, but many of you have come to Gurgaon know him. He used to be my secretary. And I said, "Keshava," he came to relieve Leela so she could go back and cook for me again for dinner. I said, Keshava, get some paper and a pen and write down. And I dictated the whole first part of this course, the introduction, and the entire outline. It took me a year and a half, but I showed through this course and through our experience at Ananda and through the teachings of my guru how, yes, in everything that you want to do in this world, you can be more successful if you understand how you can bring God into your daily life. Now, this is what I mean about Kriya Yoga in daily life. We need to understand that we have within us the capacity to be sounding boards for that infinite one. And you will find that if you do, somehow everything works right and in incredible ways. Years ago, I lived in America, I started the community, but I felt the inspiration from Divine Mother to come back to India after 10 years there. And people gave me money, and I had some money saved up from classes, and I had about $2,000. I thought that would take me to India and suffice for me to stay a little while and then come back. But just 2 weeks before I was to take this journey, my car broke down. I was coming into San Francisco, and it threw a rod, or whatever the word is. I really don't know enough about cars to explain these things. And I realized that this old clunker had to be sold, and I had to get another car. But I thought, well, what did I do? If I get a new car, I can't go to India. And yet, if I do go to India and come back, I need a car. I live up there in the mountains where having a car is an essential thing. And so I didn't know where to go. There were no temples to go to, no churches to go to. I sat with a few friends in a restaurant, and you can't really get much chanting and meditation done in a restaurant. But I finally said, well, Divine Mother, I can't get any clear answer from you, but I have to put it to you this way, that if you still want me to go to India, my common sense tells me I need a car. If you still want me to go, you will have to reimburse me. I just put it to her that way. And so I put down $1,100 on a new used car, but a decent car. And this was Friday night. Monday morning, the following Monday, I got a letter in the mail from somebody I did not know. He said that I want you to use this check as Divine Mother wants you to. Now, in America, who talks of God as Divine Mother? Nobody. But this letter said, use it as Divine Mother wants you to. It was a check for $1,000. So I was able to come to India. And here in India, I was in Delhi and I was going to Calcutta. And there was a Dr. Mishra I had been wanting very much to see again. He'd gone back to India. He was a friend of mine. He'd been studying in UC Davis. And I didn't have his address. And the one regret that I had in coming to Calcutta was that this friend of mine who lived in Bhubaneswar, I didn't know how to reach him. And I thought, I'm so close and I can't go see him. What a pity. So anyway, I landed at Dum Dum Airport, and the people who were going to come and meet me were not there. It turned out that they had been delayed by traffic and they couldn't come. But you know what happens when you're in an airport and you don't find the people there that you want to meet and you don't know where to go and you don't know what to do? You go rushing to a telephone. Well, I was just thinking, I'm here in Divine Mother's hands. So I said, Divine Mother, what do you want? Just like that, with complete confidence, she'd take care of it. I didn't worry about it. Just in that moment, somebody stopped in front of me. He said, what is your good name? And I told him, Swami Kriyananda. He said, oh, I thought you must be he. I have been seeing your photographs in an album of a friend of mine, a Dr. Mishra, and I've been longing to meet you. And I said, well, I want to meet him. Can you give me his address? He said, no need to. I came to Calcutta. I just landed right now with the express purpose of going to see him. He's visiting Calcutta, and I will take you to him. So this thing I have seen again and again. You've seen these wonderful miracles in autobiography of a yogi, and you think, well, maybe for a great master, but we can do it. If we live for God, he takes care of us. We need to get rid of that bundle of self-definitions that surrounds us and dig down into where we are. Go into deep meditation and bring that consciousness into outward life so that you don't have meditation here and and business there, the owner of the mall in which we have a shop in Gurgaon said that business is one side, God is the other. They have nothing to do with each other. That is wrong. God is everywhere. God is in everything. And if we live in Him, we can do everything better. You know, I didn't study music. Well, I did study for a semester, but I never went to class and never did any assignments, and I was absolutely fed up with college. So I cannot give that as an example. The only thing I remember learning in that course was that the bass should go in the opposite direction from the treble when possible, and you shouldn't have barrel of fifths. Well, that's not much. But when the thought came to me that I can express this teaching in music, suddenly music came to me. And I have found again and again that I have to know very clearly what I want. I can't just say, God, give me a melody. But if I know what I want, then I say, God, give me this melody that says this, 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 this. It comes immediately. And I've seen this again and again. We had in Palo Alto, in Menlo Park, there was a bookstore there, and Virginia Sharpman was the owner. And I used to go there. They had good metaphysical books. It was called East West. And I went in one day, and she said to me, you know, I'm getting old. I'm 75 years old now. And I would like to sell this, and I see what you've done with your life, and I would like to sell it to Ananda. Would you like to buy it? And that was a big expense. We didn't have any money. We'd sort of somehow keeping our chins above the water, but that's about it. And yet I paused for a second, and I felt yes. And I said, yes, we will. Well, that yes, we will was a small thing to say, but the fact of doing it was something else. We needed $45,000 in a matter of 2 weeks, and I didn't know where it would come from. But somebody sent us $36,000, somebody else gave us more. Everything, when you do it with God, it works. I want you to know this, because I've seen this happen hundreds of times. And if you live with Him, you will see that He does take care of you. Now, here's coming back to the cosmic view that I wanted to give to you. In fact, this is a point that I cannot make, but my guru stated as a fact. He said they will never find a missing link. Man was a special creation. Now, I can't take it further than that because I can't make it scientific. But it's amazing how many things Sri Yukteswar said have been proved true, things that they didn't know at that time. In those days, they thought the sun was the center of the universe. He said, no. In those days, they thought that matter is solid. He said, no, it's energy. Only with 10 years later, 11 years later, they found that matter is energy, that light is the reality, that the sun is not the center of the universe. Many things that he said have been proved true already in this little bit of time that has elapsed since he wrote that book, The Holy Science. But some things have not yet been found. They have not yet been found what he said, that the real explanation for the yugas is the precession of the equinoxes. Scientists insist that it's the tilt of the earth. He said, no, that's not it. It's the movement of the sun around its dual. Walter Crittenden has written a book on the lost star, he calls it, in which he shows to his satisfaction that we do have a dual and where it is. And another thing that Sri Yukteswar said that science has not yet proved is that we have a dual and that we rotate around it. But the scientists, not very many years ago, were beginning to question, do we have a dual? There's an awful lot science doesn't know. In fact, in my book, The Revelations of Christ, I make the statement that all that science has really been able to do is rummage in the cosmic pantry looking for something to nibble on. There are fantastic levels of reality that only a yogi can know. You cannot know everything outside. This is why my guru said, it's good to be a scientist, it's good to help people to understand how to make a better world and so on, but you'll never find the truth that way. If you go to a palace, once you get to know the owner of the palace, the king of that palace, he can take you around the ground and show you everything. But until then, you can look at all this and you still won't know the king and you won't know what the palace is. My guru, just a few months before I came to him, had a cosmic vision in which he was taken by Divine Mother all over the universe. And he was laughing. He said, now I know how you've done it all. But this is only a great yogi can know how it all happens. A great yogi can manifest universes. This is something that in the causal world, people have that power. We're living in a world that's altogether different from what we see with our senses. But our senses, scientists now are able to give us only a small part of the whole spectrum. Only a yogi, by becoming the atom, can understand everything there is to know about the atom. So the real science, we need to understand that religion and science are not different. If we can get religion out of this silly box of thinking that we believe this and believe that, and understanding that the purpose of religion is to know truth, and that that truth cannot be different from the truth of science, it has to be one. The greatest scientists in the world are all yogis, because they can make things happen no scientist could make happen. They understand things that can never be understood on that level. But with the spine, here's an interesting thing. That energy in the spine, once the body of an animal, our animal, is so clarified that it can understand that that energy can be brought up in the spine, then you can attain enlightenment. You know, in the Mahabharata, it's a very interesting thing. It's not a great story. I mean, yes, it's a great story, but it's not only a story. It's a great allegory. And many things in that allegory are quite different from what they seem to be. For example, you know the story of how Arjuna comes back with Draupadi and says that he has won her, and his mother doesn't know what it is yet, and she says, as a mother would say in such circumstances, whatever it is, you must share it with your brothers. Well, to share your wife with your brothers is not quite the norm in India. They have polyandry in Tibet, but they don't have it in India. And here we have Draupadi had to marry all five of the Pandavas. It seems like a very strange story, but it's not a story, it's an allegory. The Pandavas stand for the five chakras. This is why Kunti is the mother of the three chakras from here, here, and here, the upper chakras. And the Sahadeva and Nakula are twin brothers, but the mother is different. And Sahadeva is the lowest one, Nakula is the second one. All these things are symbolic. Draupadi is the Kundalini. And so you see, Draupadi has to marry all five of the brothers. Draupadi has to unite with each of the chakras in order to ascend. These are all, take Bhishma. Bhishma is a wonderful example. He stands for the ego. And so it is that Bhishma has this power not to die until he agrees to die. He agrees to give up his life, his body. Now the meaning of that is the ego is the only thing that it has to give itself up. You have to reach that point where you say, I am willing to surrender myself into the infinite. Nobody can do that for you. You have to do it. Why do you need a guru? Well, you don't need a guru until you want God. But yes, when you want God, you need a guru. And so, why? Because the ego, well, my guru told me, gave me an example. He said that there was a man who was being bothered by a demon. And so the man took a Vedic mantra and cast it on some powder to throw on the demon, because this was supposed to get rid of the demon. And when he did so, the demon left. He said, before you could say your mantra, I myself got into that powder. So how could you affect me? What this means is that the very ego with which we would try to dispel our delusions is already deluded. It already has that disease. It can't get rid of its own disease. You've got to tune your consciousness. It isn't a matter of a guru teaching you. Many gurus are monis. They don't say anything. But in attunement with him, it says in the Bible, as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. As many as received him. This doesn't mean, yes, yes, I believe in you. No. Received him into your consciousness. This is what I had discovered with my guru. By attuning my consciousness with his, I found that there were levels of understanding that I could have that I never could get on my own. That He helped me to understand how to get out of this delusion and that delusion. Attunement with him helped me to change my consciousness. It isn't that I become one with him in the sense of I become like him. This is a fascinating fact, as you'll know from Autobiography of a Yogi. Siyukteswar was a Jnana Yogi and very sort of dry in his mathematical perceptions. My guru was very much of a bhakta. And yet he found that in attuning himself with Sri Yukteswar, he developed in bhakti. He developed jnana, yes, but he developed his own nature. You know, when the sun shines through a stained glass window, it's the same sun, but it'll shine red through the red pane and blue through the blue pane and green through the green pane. And so the guru augments your power, but he works through what you are. And you remain yourself. You will never be anything but your own self. This is an interesting thing about the whole teaching of avatar. And truly speaking, an avatar is somebody who has gone through the ice, reached nirvikalpa samadhi, because he's in that water of oneness. And then with that, he looks over all his past lives and gradually dissolves all of those. This is the state of a jivan mukta. Most of the people, most of the great saints in autobiography were jivan muktas. They still had some past karma, but on that level of jivan mukta, you're already one with God. And so it doesn't much matter. It's just that in the world you can do less good than one who is a param mukta or completely one. But I asked my guru, can't you just say I'm out of this delusion? And it happens, he said, yes, you can. But most don't. They use this as an excuse. They don't care at that state because they're already one with God. And they may use it as an excuse to come back to help their disciples. But the thing is that once you become a paramukta and all your past incarnations have been dissolved in that understanding, that you see that it was God who became that pirate and that soldier and that general and that everything, then you see that it's not your karma, it's all just God who did everything. Once you achieve that state, you become one with him. Now, when you've achieved that, you lose yourself, but you can't lose anything really. And so what you retain, not your ego, but the memory, in that omniscience, you remember that you, as God, went through that particular sequence of incarnations. And so you, as that individual, can come back into this world. So when God comes back as an avatar, like Krishna, like Babaji, like Lahiri Maharshi, like Yogananda, like Jesus Christ, like Buddha, it is that particular person. He's always the same kind of person, basically. And when you find that state, you will know that it is God who has become you and then became God again. But you will always remember that you were that too. So if devotees pray to you, you can come to them in that form. So the wonderful thing is that even in that state of infinite consciousness, nothing is lost. In omniscience, you know everything, including who you were. Well, the teaching of Draupadi becoming one with all the chakras, the purpose of life is, see, everything is duality, dvaita. And here we have dvaita in the spine, which you don't have in a mollusk so much, but you do have in the vertebrate. From the lower, it has to come up and unite here. And once you become one in yourself, once you understand that your ego is only that, you know everything. That's the amazing thing, that having found the secret of one atom, you know the truth of everything. But you can't find it about an atom, but you can understand the truth of your own little ego. The atom that is you. And this atom, you can go down, you can go up, you can do all. We've made so many mistakes. But sooner or later, the time has to come when you say, I've done enough. I've tried. I've not found it. I don't want anything. I remember when I first was seeking, before I came upon Autobiography of a Yogi, how desperate I was. I saw that there's so many ways in which one can fail. One can fall, one can make mistakes. I realized I needed help. I couldn't do it on my own, but I didn't know whom to go to. When I read Autobiography of a Yogi and came to him, and he accepted me that same day. And I have to say that this is my 60th year of discipleship. I have never had a moment's doubt that he was my guru and that I needed him. Any good that I have been able to do, I have done only because I've sincerely tried to be his channel. And how successfully I've done it, I don't know. But I do understand this, that I have this particular background, education, training, mental quality, whatever it is, that tries to unite all these different things. And so I'm able to see that his teaching does it for us. That in his teaching, that's why I've often called him the guru of Dwapara Yuga. Because in that teaching, there is a union of religions, a union of science and religion, a union of the different cultures. I've traveled in so many countries, and I see that people are people. Sometimes they have one accent, sometimes another. Basically, they're all people. And so I find wherever I go, I am at home, because I'm at home in myself. You Indians and we Americans, it's all just a dream. You might be an American in your next life, and Americans can be Indians. It happens so many times. I went to the Book of Bhrigu one time, and it told me that in one life I was in the time of Kurukshetra. And then, this is my eighth life since then, he said that I'd lived for many centuries in the astral world. And as a child, I always felt that world was more real than this world. But how many lives we go? And finally, we have to reach that point where we must surrender ourselves to the Guru, and he offers us up to God. He doesn't want anything from us. His only purpose is to help us to understand who we are. Now, the thing is that you find this unity in all creatures, but particularly in vertebrae. You know, in a fish, if you eat fish, you see those two little strands that go down the spine? Those are the ira and the pingala of a fish. We all have this, but man has the capacity to understand. Man has the capacity to bring all this together and to magnetize those two things. You know, we need the magnetism to attract the divine consciousness. We are like a bar magnet. A bar magnet can be magnetized in two ways. One is put it next to a magnet, and the influence of that magnet will magnetize it. So being next to a guru, that means in your consciousness, because it doesn't mean a physical thing. By being in tune with him, he magnetizes you. There's another way you can magnetize a bar of metal, and that is by sending an electric force through it. All the molecules in that metal have to be sent. They all have their own magnetism. They have to be redirected, so they all go in the same direction, and then the metal has magnetism. Well, our molecules are our samskars. And the guru, attunement with the guru, gradually moves all those samskars in an up and down direction. So does this yoga, Kriya Yoga, which brings the energy into the spine and magnetizes the spine, first in the Ida and the Pingala and then in the Sushumna. Yoga is a fantastic science, and Kriya Yoga is the most central of all yogas, more central than bhakti, karma, jnana, etc., because these are bypaths. They depend on temperament. But finally, you have to reach that stage of stillness within. This is the path of Raja Yoga and of Kriya Yoga. Kriya Yoga has another thing, and that is the more you practice Kriya, the more you understand that everything that you do in this world is a reflection of you. You get that magnetism in yourself, and you discover that whenever I find something beautiful, I was in Puri one time many, many years ago, and a sadhu there, he was 132 years old, so you can figure he had something. But he said to me that you should not enjoy a beautiful sunset. I thought, what a dry way. My guru taught differently. He said, yes, enjoy everything, but with the joy of God. Let God enjoy it through you. When you offer your food up before you eat, offer it to give to God. You're not giving it away. You still have to eat it. Isn't that right? What you really should be doing is share it with God so you feel him working, eating through you, eating with you. Everything you do, feel that God is right there with you. Don't talk to him as if he were third person, he or she. Say you, You are with me. Talk to him as I and you. You will find that in this case, when you feel joy in this world, it isn't that thing that is joyful. It's something in you that responds, isn't it? When you feel happy, this is something everybody knows, there's an uplifting energy. When you feel sad, there's a downward flowing energy. This is true. All human beings are wiser than they know. We know that we want things that make us uplifted, so we have words like that. In every language, probably, I know 9 languages, and I imagine all of them. When you feel good, you say, I feel high, I feel uplifted, I feel like flying, I feel all sorts of words. But if you feel unhappy, you feel downcast, you feel depressed, you feel heavy, all these things indicating a downward energy. Kriya Yoga helps you to uplift that energy, and so that when you see something that you enjoy, you see it's here that you're feeling that joy. And so you take it inside and offer it up to God. Kriya Yoga in daily life means that understanding that everything you enjoy in life, everything is an upward movement. And there's another thing. What about the unenjoyment, the sorrow, the unhappiness? You'll notice that every time you try to do something and then fail, there's a sort of a depression. You go into yourself. Well, this is what the downward movement in Sushumna does, in the Pingala does. You go into yourself. But because you think that what you were looking for was outside, you just sort of get back, get your strength together, and come out all over again. What Kriya Yoga helps you to do is to understand that when the energy comes down, you want to go into yourself. And so with Kriya Yoga going up and down, gradually come to the point where the Kundalini can rise in the spine and unite itself with the Sahasrara finally. This is the goal of all religion. Religion has nothing to do with outward forms. These are ideals that you worship. But the ideal is how to change yourself. The goal of it all is inside. Organizations are not the way to go. There is a story in Italy about some women who were together, and one woman said, well, my son is a priest, and everybody who addresses him says, father. And the next woman said, well, my son is a bishop, and everybody calls him Your Excellency. And the third one said, well, my son is a cardinal, and everybody greets him and says, Your Grace. And one woman said, well, my son is the Pope, and when people meet him, they say, Your Holiness. So the fifth woman was sort of out of it. She says, well, my son is very big and very tall and very massive, and every time people see him, they say, oh, my God. The reality we're looking for is not outward. You're not more holy because you have a better position. This is what Lahiri Maharshi taught. Being a householder or a sannyasi is not very important. The important thing is, who are you in your heart? Change your life and you can change thousands. But above all, change your life and you can find God. And what my guru came to show us is a way of life that unites everything. It's an incredible teaching. And if you read my books, all of them have this one purpose. Now I'm going to sit down here. Would you bring me my chair here, please? Because actually, for some reason, I guess it's my old age, I'm 81 years old, but my shoulders begin to hurt when I stand too long. So now I can lean them. Great. Got it. And so, when you understand that everything that you are looking for is inside yourself, it does not mean what so many sadhus have talked. You know, I think that part of the trouble in India has been that being invaded by Muslims, being invaded by Christians, being invaded by all these different people, there's come a certain negativity in the approach to religion. Neti, neti, not this, not that. But you know, the ancient Vedas were very positive. And they turned all of life into a holy experience. We must understand that nothing is not spiritual if you do it in the right spirit, if you do it for God. My guru made a very interesting statement in his autobiography, and later editions changed this, but I have to tell you, it's in the original one. He said that living the divine way in the world, fulfilling your worldly responsibilities, that means grihastha and everything. is indeed the higher path, higher than sannyas, provided you can live in this world without attachment. Well, that proviso is a very big one. Very few people can have somebody that close to them and not get personal. And so to be a householder and a true yogi is more difficult, yes. But the important thing is not whether you are a householder or a yogi the important thing is to be a yogi, not whether you are a sannyasi or a householder. I'm a sannyasi because honestly I just don't see any point in not being, but I don't want to impose that on you because I know that the important thing is wherever you are, wherever God places you in your life, if you live in that thought that nothing belongs to me, it is all His, then you can find God, and in this life too. Through Kriya Yoga, you can magnetize your spine and lift your consciousness and find that everything you do is a part of God. You can go through that ice. If you can reach that state of Jivan Mukta, you should be able to do this in this life. You know, there was one woman whom Yogananda met. She was in her 80s, and she had been an atheist all her life. But when she met him, she was completely transformed and she became very, very sincere spiritually. He said that in the remaining years of her life, and at 80 you don't have that many years left, she attained salvation. You can attain it. You must work for it, however. Don't waste your lives with bridge parties and tea parties and this party and that party. Don't waste your life thinking that I've got everything I want because I won the lottery. You won't have anything. Nothing is worthwhile until you have understood that there is only that one truth, Satchidananda. You are that. And your goal in life is to know that the bliss that you are seeking is the bliss of your own nature. There is nothing else. What the great masters have taught, they've all taught the same thing. It's as if you were on a planet, and the goal of that of life on that planet were go to the equator. And everybody north of the equator is told he should go south. And everybody south is told to go north. But human nature being what it is, you reach the equator and you keep going. And so as you get down south of the equator, you see people coming north, and you say, no, you're supposed to go south. No, no, you're supposed to go north. And so they all fight. And so the religions fight. There's no need for fighting. They're all saying the same thing, come back to your own self. But if people have gone too far this way, then they have to be brought this way. If they've gone too far this way, they've got to be brought back that way. But every true master is one with that same truth and teaches that same truth. It does not mean that all religions are equally the same and equally true. I have to say that too. There are false religions as well as true religions. But that religion which teaches you that the goal of life is to unite yourself with Him who created you, that the goal of life is to merge into Satchidananda, to become bliss. There's other things Mahabharata that are very interesting. Think of Ashwatthama. You know, it's a very strange episode in the Mahabharata where Ashwatthama, is it Yudhishthira who kills him? You can't kill him. It's Drona. He can't kill Drona. You see, Drona is the guru of the Pandavas and of the Kauravas. He's the guru of your good qualities as well as your bad qualities. Why does he fight for the bad side? Because the bad side is what's really sustained by habit. It's true that if the more you meditate, the more you want to meditate. So some habit works on that side. But basically, what guides your higher qualities, your humility, devotion, all those qualities that raise you spiritually, these things come more from superconsciousness. It's the power to find God. This is why it says in the Bible, He gave them the power to become the sons of God. That power to unite yourself with Him is what it's all about. But in uniting yourself with that, you must understand that you can't do it only by your own intellect. You've got to use a certain amount of trickery, and this is where that story of, you know, when they say to Drona, because this would discourage Drona, saying Ashwatthama is dead, But they've named an elephant after Ashwatthama. And so Ashwatthama, the elephant, is dead. But this has a very deep meaning, that you need to use a certain amount. For example, you have attachment to money. There's nothing wrong with saying my money attachment, or I'm attached to alcohol. I don't have it. I remember when I was a young man, I used to smoke. And I, at the age of 21, decided I wanted to become a hermit and to seek God. And I thought, well, whoever heard of a hermit who smokes? And I couldn't imagine. I mean, I wouldn't have the money to go out and buy cigarettes, and besides, I would be too far away from where they sell cigarettes, so I decided I had to give it up. But it was not an easy thing. It was like what Mark Twain used to say, that smoking is the easiest thing in the world to give up. I've done it 1,000 times. And so every time I would stop smoking, then I would drink coffee with my dessert, and it would be so nice to have a cigarette, and I was so used to that cigarette that I would smoke, well, just one. Well, you know what happened. And after a year, but you know the difference in my way of doing it and most people's way, I discovered a deep truth. I didn't say, oh, I failed again, I'm so weak, I'm no good. I said, I haven't yet succeeded. Just do that with yourself. Anytime there's something you want to overcome and you slip back, to say, I haven't yet succeeded. You have to play tricks with your own mind. You have to say, I don't want it, even though you know in your heart that maybe you do a little bit want it, but only that way can you begin to kill that habit. There's nothing you can't overcome. But you have to give it time, and you have to tell yourself, and this is where the trick comes in. Now, another very interesting story in that Mahabharata is Ashwatthama himself. He represents attraction. Now, Ashwatthama, after the whole battle, after the war of Kurukshetra, goes out and kills all the heroes. What a terrible sin, you think. But actually, this is what you will find, that if you feel, for example, here's this beautiful woman or beautiful man, and you feel attracted to him, it's hard to get that thought out of your mind. Concentrate on the bliss inside, and you will find there's so much attraction there, everything else dissolves. It doesn't mean anything. The same with money, the same with everything. When you see all the Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata is a battle between the powers of light and the powers of darkness within each individual. You are a whole population in yourself. All these qualities that you've developed over the so many incarnations. But with that, you have to understand that in the end, all of them have to be dissolved. How can they be dissolved in the end? Well, Krishna says that there's no such thing as death. This is what the Bhagavad Gita means. He's not speaking of outward war. It's true there is such a thing as a righteous war. I won't go into that one. It's a long thing, but you have to understand. If there's somebody coming to your village, let us say, and shooting everybody, and you just try to be peaceful and say, peace, my brother, he'll just shoot you too. You've got to kill sometimes. You have to get rid of people who are a menace to society. This is a subject which certainly deserves discussion. I'm not going to discuss it, so I'll leave you hanging on that one. But the thing is that what Krishna is really saying is that there is no such thing as loss. You lose a quality of anger, greed, lust, passion, whatever it might be. You don't become less a human being. This is the fear that Arjuna expresses in the first chapter. You don't become less. The same energy that went toward those things goes into higher things. The same energy that went toward anger goes toward calmness, but it doesn't remain anger. It doesn't remain lust. It doesn't remain any of these negative qualities. It comes into an opposite quality that's different. There's one thing that does remain: attraction. God is rasa. God is supremely enjoyable. The attraction to that joy, the attraction to that bliss, ananda, remains as an attraction. What have we done now? Okay, so you can see me. All right. But I'm nearly finished. When you can, instead of seeing something that draws you and think, oh, beautiful, oh, lovely, I want it. Instead of thinking that, just feel this bliss inside. Master used to say that You don't have to overcome things. You have to find something to replace them with. Somebody who loves stale cheese, give him good cheese and he'll not like that cheese. So you feel the attraction of this ananda and love and bliss in yourself. And then these things dissolve. They don't mean anything. So Ashwatthama is cursed to remain immortal. But it's no curse. What it really means is that that same quality of attraction remains. You become supremely attracted to bliss. And he kills all those other qualities, because those qualities mean, I am being humble, I am being kind, I am being serviceful, I am being all these good qualities. That's still satyaguna. You have to go beyond satyaguna. You have to go triguna rahitam, beyond everything. And so when you can find that supreme bliss, all these things, you don't have to be. Somebody said to my guru once, how humble you are. He said, how can there be humility when there is no consciousness of self? You in that state, there's nothing that remains, just that one, Satchidananda. And these great masters who come back into this world again and again, as Krishna says in chapter 4 of the Gita, I incarnate myself again and again in this world to bring virtue up and to punish crime and to help people realize what life is really all about. We need constant reminders, because people debauch their own religion. And what the great masters teach, they finally bring it down and down to a level where it's really not that different from everything else. They have to keep coming to tell us again and again, the goal of life is to know yourself, and that self is God. You are God. You are no different from Krishna and Jesus Christ and Buddha and all those great masters. You are that. But you have created all this baggage of self-definition. You have to destroy that. That's why in your daily life too, you should try to tell yourself that I don't want anything. When people praise me, I don't want to accept it. I remember I met a woman after a big public function, and we were talking for a while, and then I asked her name, and she told me, and she asked me, what was your name? And I told her, Swami Kriyananda. She said, oh, Swami Kriyananda, but you're famous. I said, well, maybe, but why this but? And she said, well, every other famous person I've met seemed somehow important. I thought that was the best compliment I've ever had. I don't want to be important. I'm not important. None of us is important. We're all very important, however, not in ourselves, but as children of that one God. You are a child as much as Krishna ever was. You have to realize that's who you are. Kriya Yoga can help you to understand that. And you must bring that teaching into your daily life by making it a practice to think you, share with everything you do. Don't just give your food to God. Say, God, be with me while I eat. I offer, I share it with you. When you're working, feel that I'm working with you. When you're, yes, making love, feel you're doing it with him. Everything that you do, feel that you share it with him, and you will find that there is bliss in everything. And finally, what you will find also is that bit by bit, you no longer care about these things, because he's so rasha. He's everything you want. And the more, it's neti neti until finally you find that everything is a part of him. You are a part of him. You are all that you ever sought. There's a wonderful story about the musk deer, who at a certain season in the year, it secretes in a pouch in its navel the fragrance of musk, and it runs wildly looking everywhere. Where can the source of this fragrance be? And sometimes it dashes itself off high crags to its death, and the hunter comes and takes that pouch and sells it for a costly spice in the market. And the poet said, oh, musk deer, if only you had understood that that fragrance you were seeking was inside yourself. You cannot find joy inside in anything except to the extent that you are capable of receiving it and enjoying it here. All your joy is in you, not outside. All your understanding is in you, not outside. Kriya Yoga helps you to develop that consciousness where you don't lose the ability to enjoy with people, to be a friend to people, to tell a good joke. My master could laugh till the tears ran down his cheeks. Yet you looked into his eyes. They were calm. There was no ego there. You understood. I remember one time I was at a function at Bar Mitzvah. It's a Jewish ceremony, sort of like to welcome young boys into adulthood and the responsibilities of that. And I'm not a Jew, but I did Hatha Yoga, and so they had me come and demonstrate Hatha Yoga. And afterwards, it was in Beverly Hills, and the people there are all very intellectual, very arrogant, very materialistic. And this intellectual psychiatrist was trying to grill me as to how I could have such a stupid belief as what I have. And I tried to convince him, and he couldn't understand. He just thought it was all crazy. So I started trying to tell him about a few miracles I had observed in my life. And I could see that in his mind he was thinking, maybe I can see this patient at 10 a.m. next Wednesday. I saw it wasn't getting anywhere. And I used to, often my guru would have me serve guests and do the postures for them, and then after the guests left, he would sit and we would talk around the luncheon table. And at this day, this was just a few days after that Beverly Hills experience, he said to me, "By the way, when you're with materialistic skeptics and atheists and so on," he said, "don't talk about miracles." And I was surprised. I said, "You knew?" Because he was long far away from that occasion. He answered me in a way that absolutely astounded me. He said, "I know every thought you think." Well, that's something. To reach that stage, you can do that. I found that in him. Every time I thought anything that needed to be corrected in this way or that, he would correct it. Usually he corrected me for how to help people, how to teach people. But it was always, he knew what I was doing, he knew what I was thinking. God is there. He knows every thought. Don't think that you can hide anything from him. Think, "Oh, well, I did this, and I know it's a sin, therefore, no, I hope you didn't notice." He noticed, because he's you. He did it through you. When you become Jivan Mukti, you have to understand that it was he who did everything through you. All those incarnations, he lived them through you in that form. He dreamed this whole wonderful show. It's all he doing it. And we have to get out of this and realize that it's he. So in your life, try to share everything with him. When you make a mistake, say, "God, help me. I know I was wrong in this. Help, give me the strength. Give me the understanding." He will give it to you in time. When that moment comes, there was some quality I wanted to overcome because I used to be very intellectually arrogant. I had read Stavridis so much, studied so much, and I was intelligent. I could beat anybody in discussion. And I got sick of this quality, and my guru wanted me to get rid of it. And one night I sat in meditation, and I just looked at this quality in myself. I said, "I'm so tired of dealing with this. I don't want to take it." And with all my energy, I just gave it to him. And I felt so free. And I remember coming out, and he was standing on the grounds out there looking out over the city of Los Angeles. And I knelt to touch his feet, and he said, "Very good." But ever since then, that quality has not been there. No quality, no matter how important or how big or difficult it may seem, God will take all of it from you. If you let him be a part of the game, bring him into it. Don't hide yourself from him. You're not that. You're an ever-perfect being. When you're dharmic, you will find, you know, we have stores. We have to support our community, and so we have these shops. In Gurgaon, we have the Wishing Tree and the Metropolitan Mall. But people come to those stores because they like to be with people who smile, who welcome them. There was a woman in Taormina in Sicily. I went to her shop when I was down there on vacation. And I wanted to buy a hat. I needed one. I said, "Well, which kind of hat do your customers like?" She said, "I don't care. They just come and take it and pay me. That's all I think about is their money." I said, "Here you are, 8 hours a day or whatever, thinking of your customers as just money bags. Wouldn't it be much nicer if you could think of them as your friends? Wouldn't you be more happy if you treated them all friendly?" So she didn't say anything, and I left. I didn't buy a hat. And a year later, I came back there for a vacation. I was walking down the street. I saw this same woman outside her shop, and she came to me and kissed me on both cheeks. They do this in Italy.
I said, stay away. But anyway, she kissed me on both cheeks, and she was so moved. She said her whole life had been changed by that simple encounter. And they gave us wine at the hotel as return customers. So I didn't know whom to give this wine to. So I thought, I'll give it to her. She was weeping. You can change people's lives if you help them to understand that whatever you're doing, think of your customers as friends. Think of them as Adam Smith said, well, the only thing you think about is your own profit. But that businessman who thinks in terms of profit and also people will have more profit. I don't say it's wrong to have profit. It's wrong to make a living. No, it's a part of God's show. Do it for Him. You'll see so much. Everything becomes better if you bring God into the picture. And if you can feel that everything you're doing begins with this current of energy in the spine. Kriya Yoga is the most wonderful science. Well, look, I've been talking. I could go on talking, but I don't think that it's good to be talking too long. I want to leave you with something and let you get out of here and go and have your dinners and everything. So let me come, have the singers come up, and let's first have a moment of silence so you can practice silence with me. Then we will do the other. Sit upright and put your hands upward on your, the palms upward on your thighs at the junction of the abdomen, and put your mind at the point between the eyebrows. And feel that all your consciousness is centered at that point. Look up toward it. And mentally pray, reveal thyself.